Absolutely. No, that's exactly right.
Really
the rationale for doing it is...
I should have grabbed that name.
Yes, it's real. They're not low-income.
At least they have.
I wasn't sure if Senator Lori was going to be coming.
Oh, so, yeah.
Senator, I'm thank sure. You. Let me get you a packet. I'm sorry.
So it really is.
Is this the packet?
There's more information.
Okay.
Ask members and staff who are joining us at the table to take their seats, please.
That's okay. We switched, I guess. I don't know why.
Call to order this meeting of the Committee on State and Local Government Operations and Oversight. We are coming together today to listen to presentations on enhanced driver's licenses, which is a phenomenon that is gaining more and more appeal to, especially to border states. We are joined today by conference call by Representative Bill Huizenga from the Michigan House of Representatives, the author of a EDL bill in Michigan, which I understand has just, I think, finished its final hurdle, and also by Pete Schultz, who is the director of the International Falls Convention and Visitors Bureau. Welcome, gentlemen. For your benefit, I'm going to ask the members who are present from our committee and others to identify themselves so that you will perhaps recognize their voices when they ask a question or make a comment. So, Senator Marty, if you would identify yourself, please, and indicate where your constituency is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm John Marty. I represent 7 suburbs just north of St. Paul. Welcome to the committee.
Senator Sandy Pappas, I'm a state senator from St. Paul.
And Ann Rest, I chair the committee, and my constituency, my district, is the western suburbs of Minneapolis. And to my left is Peter Brickwitty, my legislative assistant, who has organized and guided this this hearing, and for which I am very grateful. Next to him,
I'm Bonnie Berzovsky, Senate counsel to the Transportation Committee.
I'm Senator Kathy Sharon. I represent Senate District 23, which includes some of Blue Earth County, Nicola County, and a little bit of Sibley County.
Leroy Stump, State Senator from Senate District 1, which is up in the northwest corner of the state. We border Canada, both the province of Manitoba and Ontario.
Thank you very much. And we are going to begin with a presentation from Becky Loomis, who we invited to come from the state of Washington. She is the Assistant Director of the Driver Services Division, the Department of Licensing, the state of Washington. And you will find a biography of her in the materials that are in your packets. Ms. Loomis, welcome to the committee. We're very pleased to have your presentation.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'd like to thank you very much for inviting us from Washington State. We're having great weather, as you are here. The rain's starting to set in. But it's always great to have fall coming in with the beautiful colors. We really appreciate the opportunity to share with you our experience in Washington State. We had the opportunity to begin a program that became the first in the nation and have had the opportunity to share the information and our lessons learned with many other states. So thank you again for this opportunity.
Good to see you.
As you know, the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative came about after the 9/11 Commission results from the events on that day. So in starting in summer of 2009, there will be a requirement for you to cross the countries that are contained within the Western Hemisphere Travel Area to require a passport or an alternative document to cross the borders, either by land or by sea. For us, the biggest concern for us was obvious, our British Columbia partners there, because we have always maintained very good trade and tourism, and a lot of travel, and families live across the border, and so we wanted to look for opportunities. Our governor came together with Premier Campbell from British Columbia and decided that we needed to look at an initiative and how we might be able to maintain that trade and tourism and that relationship we've long time had with our Canadian partners. So as a result of that, we came up with the concept of looking at an enhanced driver's license. Since the law allowed us to develop an alternative document, we believed that we could actually present an alternative document that would meet the requirements for WHTI travel. Our state initiative, as we looked at what we were going to require to accomplish this, felt that we needed to have legislation to be able to support the pilot program. So as a result of that, we proposed legislation late 2006 and then was actually presented to our legislature in the spring of 2007. One of the concerns we had was that we wanted to make sure that everything we thought we were going to need to have to do the pilot, that we needed to include in the legislation. Keep in mind, our legislature met in January, the late January 2007. We're drafting the information in 2006. We started meeting with Homeland Security in late 2006, the fall of 2006, looking at the requirements. So we didn't know everything we had to know and to have with the requirements for our legislation, so we thought it was best to make sure that we included every possible aspect within the legislation so that we would not encounter any conflicts as we are trying to build a program. So with that, we made sure that we could enter an agreement with Homeland Security. So we specified that in the legislation. We wanted to make sure that we had the authority to do the one-to-many biometric, which is a facial recognition system. We also wanted to make sure that we could share the biographic and the photo with the Customs and Border Patrol Agency. Our law did allow us to share photo information with law enforcement if there's a criminal activity or a criminal investigation going, but we felt we wanted to make sure that there was no challenge with us sharing the information with Homeland Security at the border. We also wanted to make sure that people knew that we were going to include an RFID chip within our enhanced driver's license. And again, that was one of the requirements that Homeland Security said. They were looking at the opportunities to facilitate border crossing. And one of those pieces of technology that would assist with that was to have RFID chip within the enhanced driver's license. So we wanted to make sure that everybody knew that we were going to include that within our program. As part of our responsibility, we had to build a business plan that Homeland Security also had to approve. What we ended up having to look at was Homeland Security provided us with some minimum standards. As a result of that, we ended up conducting a gap analysis of what our current processes, our technology, our security requirements that were required under the minimum standards, and made sure to see where we stood within those requirements. What we found, there were some changes we were going to have to make. Many of those changes surrounded around the requirements of our staff to make sure they had background checks, to make sure that they had good fraud detection training, which is one of the basic requirements as you're looking at identity documents. We also needed to look at our business flow, and part of that was to look at what equipment we might use within the new process in order to achieve security standards that they were looking for within those requirements. As we've talked to other states are at a different starting point than where Washington was. Some states already have a two-person process. Therefore, their analysis did not require some of their business flow to change. Some states already have legal presence. That also was another change for us that's different. So it really depends on where Minnesota is in particular with compared to those gap analysis to determine what changes you will have to accomplish within your business flow, within your security process, within your card production technology, as well as what equipment you may use to verify the authentication of the documents you're using. So with that analysis, that'll help you better determine what are the significant changes you may have to encounter if you were to move forward with the implementation of an enhanced driver's license program. What we found is one of the things we needed to do was to look at technology. Technology is always can be an advantage to us as we use it. It surely is not the only thing that we use to look at to determine fraudulent documents, but we looked to see if there was technology out there that could assist us with scanning documents and also looking for security features that might be contained within those documents that we use to determine the identity of the individual. So we did purchase some identity document scanners. Also scanners that would retain the documents within our system so that we would be able to conduct audits as we went down further the road to verify and confirm that our business processes and our staff were adhering to our policy and procedures. So it was a significant change for us. The other thing was that obviously the RFID and the MRZ technology, and I'll show you a diagram of our card in just a minute, but those were the requirements that we had to commit to Homeland Security. That to them was a deal breaker if we could not commit to that. That is why we included it in our legislation, that we would specifically include that so that there would not be an issue down the road. One of the deal breakers for us was that we would not share our database with Homeland Security. They initially started out that they wanted to have a copy, a mirror of our database, and we said no, we would not provide them with our database, that we would actually provide them access to the database but not give them our database. And so each state is looking at that from a slightly different perspective, and that would be one of the things that you all would need to look at. But all those items needed to be included in the business plan, which Homeland Security is required to sign off on as well as the state. Our enhanced driver's license program was voluntary, and we stressed that very much and included that in our legislation as well, because one of the concerns was that if people were forced to obtain an enhanced driver's license, that would create then some issues for people that they didn't have a choice. So we wanted to make sure that people had an opportunity to opt out or opt into the program, so it is voluntary. The cost was an additional $15. As we walked into the program, we started out as a pilot. Homeland Security says, you will do a pilot, and we will work with you on this pilot. Well, not long after we had signed the Memorandum of Agreement in March of 07, after the legislation had passed, the Secretary from Homeland Security, Secretary Chertoff, started referring to it as a program. Once he started referring it to as a program, it was no longer a pilot. Keep in mind the timing of when we passed our legislation, we got our budget. We were operating from the perspective that we were going to be a pilot and not a program, that it was something that was going to be fully implemented. So we had to shift our gears very quickly with that and start looking at how are we now going to make this a program and sustain it over time. So one of the things we had to do was to really focus in on making the changes in our business flow, security, to make them that they were going to be solid practices and that they would sustain us over time. Because, again, we were operating from a perspective of being a pilot, and now we've moved into a program within a matter of months. One of the key things also is making sure that the card changes that we were going to incorporate into the enhanced driver's license were in compliance with what we refer to as AMBA, which is an Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators. They set standards out for security, for training, and for card design. So we wanted to make sure our new card design was going to be consistent with the next level of card development and security features. So we moved our card in that direction. Again, we didn't want to go forward and make changes that we were going to have to undo down the road, especially since we had now moved into a program. We also wanted to make sure that we were able to identify best practices within our new business processes. We only offer the enhanced driver's license in 14 of our 63 offices, which allows us then again to try to maintain the cost of the program as well as to look at it from a geographical area in providing the program and the opportunities for the access to the program in a limited fashion. That allowed us then to again to contain the cost of the program. We also felt we needed to make sure we educated the public. In your package, you have a CD that has information in there that shows you all the brochures that we use to educate the public. We wanted to make sure that we had informed consumers because, again, it was a voluntary program, and we wanted to make sure that they clearly understood what it meant to be involved in the Enhanced Driver's License Program. So we undertook an educational program to educate the public and to go out and make sure that they understood that. So when we went forward, we looked at developing a marketing strategy. We did some focus groups to look at what opportunity there may be there for individuals who might choose to come in and use the program, what might be some good marketing strategies as we move forward. And I'll talk a little bit more about the marketing strategies in a minute. And, of course, we also wanted to make sure that whatever we did was actually going to reduce the potential negative impact that the WHTI requirements were going to have on trade and tourism between Washington State and British Columbia. Going to give you just a real short update on where British Columbia is right now. We undertook our projects at a different timeline. British Columbia, because in where they were, the funding and other things, they chose to do a true pilot, which they started in January of 08 as well as when we did. They looked at limiting the number of participants within the program because they were looking for experiences and lessons learned from that program. So they limited the number of enhanced driver's licenses that they issued. They were free to the individuals who wanted to participate in the pilot. They did not charge an additional fee at that time. They are looking at what they may charge as an additional fee with the program once they actually move out, probably in summer of 09. They're in the process of just having awarded a new RFP, so they were taking that into consideration as well. And they're hoping to launch their program early next spring. But we have been working very close with the British Columbia staff in looking at the requirements of our program and their program and doing some comparisons to make sure that we weren't going to do something that was going to, counteract the efforts of one or the other. So we've worked very closely with British Columbia. This picture here depicts what the border probably will look like. They will have the reader about 12 feet from the actual booth for the Customs and Border Patrol agents. The individuals will pull their enhanced driver's license card out of their sleeve, hold it up. The reader will pick up the RFID number. The RFID number on that card is a unique serial number, and I'll show you that in just a minute. Then it will actually report the information to the Homeland Security's network. Every communication within the private network is secure, and it's behind firewalls. When it is transmitted between Homeland Security outside of their firewalls to Washington State, the data is encrypted. So the data is encrypted coming to us, and the data is encrypted going back to them. Within our system, we have firewalls that protect the information as it goes through within our system. Homeland Security has their system, and we have our system, and it actually goes through several different firewalls. One of the concerns with that was obviously so nobody could actually tap into the data that was being transmitted between the two organizations. The other thing is that it's a private network. So if somebody was to try to enter into Washington State's network to obtain information on a particular enhanced driver's license holder, it would not recognize that what they call IP address. It will only recognize the IP address from Homeland Security, and that's what the private network is referring to. So anybody that was going to obtain information from the state of Washington would have to be requesting the information from within Homeland Security's network system. And this was what we built to make sure that there was security between the operations and transmission of data between our two entities. One of the big things that came up during our discussions, and not only just during the legislation process of getting the legislation passed, but afterwards as well, was concerns surrounding security, privacy. Homeland Security, before they actually pursued forward and agreeing to go forward with sharing information back and forth between the Customs and Border Patrol agents and Washington State, they had to actually put together a group that actually looked at privacy concerns and then came up with a privacy impact statement on the RFID use. This document is available on Homeland Security's website. We have used the information on there to try to address concerns that have been raised from different entities within the state and outside the state as we've looked at the RFID technology. And so one of the key things within the document is that it describes all the potential risk with the use of the RFID technology and how they believe that the risks are being mitigated and whether it's a low risk or a high risk as well. So I did not include it in your packet, but the website is there for you to obtain for the document, and it is several pages. This is what our enhanced driver's license looks like. One of the emphasis that we used in trying to develop the card was not only to include the standards within the AMBA requirements, but also to make sure that we look at features that we could improve the security of the card. As you see, there's many different color designs and schematics on the card, and the emphasis with that is the harder that you make it for somebody to counterfeit the document, the better off you'll be down the road. So when you start overlaying colors or diagrams within the card, the harder it is for it to be actually fraudulently produced. In Washington State, we had been given a presentation of somebody who bought a computer at Walmart and a color printer and was able to produce Washington driver's license on the face of the card, that the individual was able to mirror a document that looked pretty real. So what we're doing now is we're moving forward to change all of our licenses with the next generation to look like this particular card, minus having the header on there that it's an enhanced driver's license. The other thing on the front of the card was that we have a flag on there denoting U.S. citizenship, which Homeland Security approved as a design for the card as well. On the back of the card, the chip is on the back of the card. It has a tiny blip on the card. You may or may not be able to see it, and you may or may not be able to feel it. That is how small it is within the card itself. It is layered within the card production, and therefore it is very, very hard to detect that it's even there. Another reminder, the chip does not have any personal information, which is different than the passport. The passport chip has actual all the biographic, all the personal information that's contained on the passport on the chip. I'm not sure if you're aware, but a few months ago, that was breached, and so people's passport information was obtained as a result of somebody being able to breach the RFID information. The card that we use right now does not have any personal information. It has a unique serial number. That serial number is read at the border. It is picked up and then transmitted through the network and then is associated with a specific record within the Department of Licensing. That record then is pulled, and then the information is transmitted back to Homeland Security. We also have the on the bottom, which is referred to as a machine-readable zone, which is also called an optical reader area. And this is similar to what's on the passport. If you have a passport and they can run it through a barcode reader, that will pick up the same information. The information will be communicated the same way that the RFID transmission takes place to the state and then returns the information back to the border.
Ms. Loomis, do you have information on how many crossings are done in a week in Washington State using people using the EDL?
I can get that information.
That
one of the things that may be right now a little bit of a challenge to get some information with that is that the readers aren't operational at the border yet. Homeland Security has installed the readers, and they've been testing them, and they've been working with them. So they have not actually got the readers up and running right now.
So the process currently is someone has to hand over their card and have it read like a passport would
be
read.
That's
correct.
And they're using the bottom portion of the MRZ to read it. The other aspect of that is that not all the borders are going to be tooled with an RFID reader, and that's why they wanted both of the technologies on there, so that if you were crossing a border that did not have a reader, that you could still use
an enhanced driver's license.
Yes.
Okay. Senator Pappas, and before I call on you, I would like to welcome a couple of other members, and Senator Day, Senator Gemsy, Senator Roebling. We recognize Senator Mua in the audience, who chairs the Judiciary Committee. And Senator Gemsy, we are joined on conference call by Representative Huizenga, who was the author of the legislation in Michigan, who will be speaking presently. And so for his benefit, and also for Mr. Schultz, who is joining us from International Falls, the director of the International Falls Convention and Visitors Bureau, I wonder if you would just introduce yourself and let them know where your district is. Senator Gemsy.
Oh, excuse me. I'm from Wilmer, Minnesota. It's all west of Minneapolis, about 100 miles. I represent Candy, Ojai, Pope, and the western third of Stearns County. Thank
Senator
you.
Day.
Senator Dick Day, southern Minnesota, about 60 miles straight south of Minneapolis-St. Paul in southern Minnesota.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. I represent the area just south of the Twin Cities, Scott County, Shakopee Prior Lake, Savage, Jordan area.
Thank you. Ms. Lewis, you may continue.
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Pappas
Thank
had
you.
A question
Madam Chair,
or comment.
For Ms. Loomis and perhaps Madam Chair, this is kind of a basic question, but why not just use a passport? Why go through all this to create a separate driver's license?
Well, Senator Pappas, I think what we have, what we're looking at in terms of an enhanced driver's license is not to have to have two documents for land crossings. Approximately only 40% of the people in Minnesota who make land crossings have a passport, as opposed to 90% of them who travel by airplane, commercial air flights, have passports as a regular document. The idea, in my mind at least, is we're making it convenient for border residents. We're making it friendly to tourism to have only, it's voluntary, only a single document. I would imagine
Madam
that
Chair, it's alternative
us,
to our existing driver's
yes,
license.
I would imagine that none of us or very rarely leaves home without our driver's license. It's carried automatically, but many of us probably don't think to carry our passport with us. So it is the opportunity, and again, voluntary. If you want to carry a driver's license and a passport, you certainly can, but it's an opportunity for those who make frequent crossings not to have to have a passport to do that by land. If they're going to travel by air, they definitely need to have a passport, even entering Canada. So if you're flying from Minneapolis to Toronto, an enhanced driver's license does not do the job. So it's a basic exploration of, is that convenience worth going to a one-card documentation of citizenship to be able to cross the border. That's how I would explain it. And as Ms. Loomis has already indicated, one of the biggest concerns is the privacy of the information and the security of the information relative to meeting standards required by DHS. Senator Day.
Madam Chair, and I've lost track of this. When, and maybe it's already in place, when is it that the date is that you can't use a Minnesota?
June 2009.
June of 2009. Okay. Right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Senator Loring. Robling.
Thank you.
Sorry.
I was wondering, what do you do about children who don't have driver's license? I have a brother-in-law who takes his four kids up to Canada fishing all the time. And they, you know, they have taken their birth certificates with them in the past, but what do you do? Can they get something like this that doesn't indicate that they're also a driver?
Yes.
Ms. Loomis.
Yeah, thank you. We
do issue. Ms. Loomis, for the purpose of our recording, we have to recognize you so that it is clear on the tape who is speaking. So we have to go through the chair. So, Ms. Loomis.
Thank you. We also offer enhanced identification cards. And so we've had families come in and bring the kids in to obtain an enhanced identification card for the kids. One of the things that we found within the focus groups that we did was that the families felt that the passport, if they had families, that the passport would really be an unreasonable amount of money to spend for a family. And therefore, they would just stop traveling to Canada if indeed they were required to have a passport and didn't have an alternative option to that. So the enhanced ID cards and the driver's license gave families then an opportunity to use something that was reasonably a cost to them that they could afford to be able to travel. So we do issue enhanced ID cards to both minors and adults who do not have a driver's license.
Thank you.
Ms. Loomis, thank you. And you can may continue.
Okay, thank you. You can't see very well, but the with the diagram on the right-hand side, there should be a border around the top portion of the block of information and also the bottom half. And I do have a sample of this. One of the concerns that people raised early on was whether the RFID number could be skimmed and be obtained by other individuals who might have a reader within the locality when they have it outside of their wallet or, you know, in the open. What we did is we purchased what is referred to as a foil sleeve. The envelope is lined with foil. It blocks the reading of the RFID tag and actually blocks it. And we actually, when we went out for the contract for this sleeve, we also asked for it to be have specifics with requirements of what the radio frequency was that it could actually block the transmission of the information. So we do issue the sleeves and provide additional sleeves if people lose them. The other test we did with the sleeve was to try to crumble it, tear it, and see whether it could be damaged during the everyday use of it. And even trying to cut it, it was very hard to do that. So we ended up going with a contractor that had a very sturdy sleeve within that. The other information we contain on the sleeve on both sides is how to make sure to protect the, any inappropriate reading of the RFID and then how to use it when they cross the border. So, again, it gives them information to be able to ensure some security and privacy in use and having having obtained this enhanced driver's license card. One of the things that we also did, which is not a requirement of Homeland Security, but we felt was an improvement to try to improve the security of the cardholder, was to use facial recognition, one-to-many biometrics. We felt that we already collect the digital photo from the individual and to then run them through a system that matches other potential applicants within our database was a good practice to ensure that the individual had one record, one driver's license, and that's a huge emphasis to make sure that you only have one record for an individual in your database. We also wanted to make sure, again, that the consumer was informed. We had them sign a disclosure statement that they understood that their photo would be submitted to a facial recognition. We also had them make sure that they understood that it was not invasive. Again, it's a digital photo that we already take of them in the process of issuing them a driver's license. And it really was a big emphasis of identity theft. Washington State had a large identity theft problem, and so we felt would also combat that problem. This is a sample of what a biometric match may look like. The individual on the left is the person that we actually would have taken the photo of. On your right-hand side is a sample of potential matches with that individual. What we then to do is we don't rely just on the system to tell us that there is a potential fraud case. We actually have intervention at two different levels with our staff. The first level go through, and look for whether it is an obvious mismatch and they should really not pursue any further investigation. And many of those do come up with a mismatch. Part of that is depending on where you set the setting for how close do you want the probability of the match to be a sure match or not. So there is some control within the system to actually use that. The higher the probability is, the less people you're going to have come up with a potential match. The lower the probability, the more likelihood you're going to have more people that will show up that look like a potential match. So we set our setting at 75%, which we felt was a good indication, and we may adjust that up or down as we start to get some more experience with this. We've had 19 cases so far that we have referred to our fraud unit. We have 7 cases that actually have been referred to law enforcement because we believe that they've had multiple matches within our system, which obviously refers to fraud and potential identity theft also.
So, I don't quite understand how that works. So there's a scanner for the gentleman's picture on the left, and then all these other people have come into the system using the same name, or they just look like this guy and they have different names.
What the system will do, will take the one photo and will match it against all the photos in our database. And then this group of people on the right-hand side are people that came up as a potentially the same person.
I see.
And so what you're looking for is to see whether individuals in your database have more than one record, more than one identity.
Did you have anything? I see. So
that's where our cases.
Some of them are the person on the left, obviously.
Yes, yes.
And then others.
I'm interested in this too, but I think I'm aware.
Thank you.
Some of the lessons learned that we have gained so far, and we still continue to learn every day as we work through our process, was that no matter how much you plan, there are still going to be things that come up that you didn't were not able to anticipate. So we plan and we reassess and assess and go back and plan again and modify if we need to. And we have done some modifications to our procedures as we've gone forward, but it's critical to make sure that we have the communication from the staff in the field. One of the things that we found was that it's an investment. And again, depending on where the state is within that gap analysis that's conducted with the Homeland Security Minimum Standards, that's going to be critical for you to understand how much of a commitment it's going to be for your state to actually participate and meet those requirements. So we dedicated IS resources and business resources to get the project. If you remember, we moved very quickly within Washington State because we thought we were going to be a pilot and moved into a program. So we had to commit some dedicated resources and shift the priorities within the department in order to make this happen and have actually producing a card in less than a year from where we started. We wanted to make sure that we looked at our equipment. Our equipment, we had some challenges with it as people, part of it was a learning curve, part of it was equipment that was new to the arena of actually conducting the authentication process. So there was some learning curve there and also some vendor requirements to go back and make some modifications. We wanted to make sure that, you know, we actually need to be in constant communication with Homeland Security to let them know what kind of experiences that our citizens are experiencing at the border, at cruise, you know, with cruise ship. So anytime people came back and said we had difficulty with getting on a cruise because of the fact they wouldn't accept the enhanced driver's license or at the border that they did not accept the border document, either on the Canadian side or the U.S. side, we have contracts within Homeland Security and also with the Canadian CBSA that they take the information and go back and work and re-educate and work with their staff at the border to make sure that the information is getting disseminated. And then also Homeland Security works very closely with the cruise ship liners to make sure that they're aware of this document being an acceptable document as we go forward. Again, privacy concerns are always going to come up. And so we have to make sure that we continually put the message out there and reemphasize the points of what we're doing. We potentially will be looking down the road to do a couple other things with the RFID chip that Homeland Security thinks would reduce the risk, although they indicate it's a small risk, but to go in and also make sure that we have an additional tag identifier that goes along with the RFID. We're taking a look at that with our vendor right now. The other piece of it is, unless you have a very clear indication of what your demand's going to be, when you start a new product, you try to go out, which is what we did with the focus groups, to try to identify what potentially we might have in the way of an interest with this. We felt we would have probably a significant interest, and certainly when the Olympics come to British Columbia, we believe we'll even have a higher interest in that. But working with the demand was a quiet challenge for us. We started out with making appointments because of the fact we did not know if our 11 offices would be over tasked with the requirement for people coming into the offices. So we made appointments initially. As we've moved through the summer months, we are moving towards removing the appointments for the majority of our offices and having now incorporate that as a walk-in process within our offices. The other thing that we did was we felt we started out because the requirements had a two-person process, and we felt that in order to meet the requirements, we had to have unique staff in each of the offices. What we learned as the staff started conducting the application process and issuing the driver's license and ID cards, that really it benefited all of us if all our staff in those offices were able to do this and process applications. So rather than having a limited number of staff in the offices to conduct the application process and the issuance and approval, that all our staff were then trained and had background checks. And again, our staff volunteered for this. They were not forced to have the background checks or volunteer for the program, but they all came forward and took the training and the background checks in order for them to be able to process the applications in those offices. So now we have 14 offices. All the staff in those 14 offices can process the enhanced driver's license, which, again, adds capacity to the ability for us to process more applications. The other thing, as I mentioned about the privacy, trying to address privacy, last legislative session we had two bills that were passed, one that made it such that we would not be required to disclose any private information under our public disclosure laws. And so that restricted the information that we collect from individuals to prove their identity and citizenship, that will not be disclosable to anybody upon request. The other thing was that because of the concern of the RFID skimming potential, that there was a law that was passed that made it a felony if you used inappropriately the RFID information, and therefore trying, again, to protect the individual's privacy and security. Best practices. What we found was that the fraud detection training that we were providing to our staff to the enhanced driver's license really was training we should do for all of our staff in all our offices. And we're just about finished with conducting that effort right now. So all our 330 staff will have undergone a significant improved fraud detection training that has been approved by AMBA. We will make sure that we have given them simple tools. What we found when we had ICE come out and do a two-day training session with our staff was that you can provide staff with very simple, inexpensive tools to help them do their job better and look for fraudulent documents when people are presenting documents for identification. We also want to look at scanning all the documents that we receive in the office versus just the enhanced driver's license document. Lines of communication. Our staff are on the front line. They see the activity changing. They see the trends. They see what's going on throughout the state with information and what people are presenting in the offices. So we made it very clear that we wanted them to let us know what information they're seeing out there so we potentially could look at whether we needed to modify our policy and procedures. And we want now to move forward with, since we had success with the biometrics, we're proposing legislation this year to use a facial recognition system for all our applicants within our Washington State driver's license identification programs, again, to try to reduce the identity theft and also to make sure that we have one driver, one record in our state, excuse me. Educating the public is a huge task, and that requires a great deal of effort. So one of the things that I mentioned before was making sure the close communication with the cruise lines, making sure that we have close communication with both the Canadian and the U.S. Customs and Border staff, and work with them to get the message out. I mentioned about the sleeves to make sure that people are informed about the use of the sleeves and making sure that we provide Q&As, and that information handout is also in your CD that we provided to you. And we also look for people to give us third-party validation, to give us feedback on what they perceive some concerns or the positive things within the program and have looked at that. Today, again, we are taking appointments until next month, but we've had 51,000 inquiries into our call center specifically for the enhanced driver's license ID card. We've scheduled over 41,000 appointments, and we have issued over 30,000 enhanced driver's license and ID cards. We also were concerned with the fact that when we started this effort, one of the things we asked Homeland Security, because it was just the Real ID had just started the process. It was passed in 2005. We started the discussions in late 2006. One of the discussions we had with Homeland Security that if we were going to undertake an effort, we wanted to make sure that the effort and the requirements that we were undertaking were not going to be contradictory to what the requirements were for Real ID. Even if our state decided to not move forward with Real ID, we wanted to make sure that the requirements were consistent and we weren't going to have two different set of requirements and therefore have to go back and redo our production of our cards and our business process. So with that, we ended up moving forward with that understanding. As you know, with the Real ID rules, they came out and they had very different changes in requirements and what the requirements were for Real ID. When we read those, we felt that our enhanced driver's license, since it was mentioned in the rules, should be accepted as a Real ID document under the law. So we sent a letter to Homeland Security requesting them to consider the enhanced driver's license as an acceptable Real ID document. We did receive a letter back from them that they said it was materially compliant until 2011, which at that point there are other requirements for Real ID that step in, and we'll see what the next few couple of years bring forward. But for right now, our enhanced driver's license is compliant with the Real ID requirements. The other thing was that we looked at was because under Real ID, they initially said that you could not do online renewals, that you had to come in face every time you came in for a renewal. That was modified in the rules. They allow for online renewals to take place every 16 years. Our licenses are good for 5 years, so therefore we went back and requested that we could do online renewals for enhanced driver's license within the two renewal cycles, and then they would have to come in for the third one after that, which would be, again, within the requirements of Real ID requirements. So we're moving forward with that, and we'll be changing that in our business plan as we move forward. For us, we've undertaken this adventure, and we think it's been a great learning adventure for us, but we believe it's just the beginning for us. And the emphasis that we propose and put out there with the enhanced driver's license is that it's faster, it's cheaper, and it fits in your wallet. And so that really is our theme that we use as we go out and market the program. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Loomis. Are there further questions or comments for her at this time? Seeing none, we thank you, and we hope you'll stand by in case questions come up. Next, we are pleased to welcome by telephone Representative Bill Izinga from the state of Michigan. Members will see his biography in the packets. He is currently serving his third term in the Michigan House of Representatives. Representative Heisinger, we welcome you to the committee and look forward to your relating the experience that Michigan is currently going through with regard to enhanced driver's license programs.
Well, Madam Chair, I thank you for the opportunity to be with you. I wish it was in person today. I could go and see some of your colleagues who have become friends. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes, it's just fine.
Okay, wonderful. I've had a chance over the past few years of attending Council of State Governments and others, becoming friends with people like Kurt Zellers and John Lesh, two very different people down in the House.
Indeed.
got some friends, college friends, and high school friends that live in the area. But I had a great opportunity to go through this summer. My family went out to the CSG conference in Rapid City, South Dakota, and we decided to take the Laura Ingalls Wilder tour through this mess and into Plum Creek. And nothing quite like watching your seven-year-old daughter running around in one of the bonnets on the banks of Plum Creek. It's pretty cool experience. Lots of great memories out there in Minnesota. I wish I could be there in person. And I commend you. I must add, 2 weeks out, less than 2 weeks out from an election, you guys holding a hearing, we haven't seen this much activity in the Michigan legislature.
Well, Representative Heisinger, none of us present are up for election, I must say. The Senate is not up for election this year. So we have a little bit more flexibility in our schedules than members of the House.
Always a blessing.
Indeed.
Well, thank you. And again, I really appreciate the opportunity. And Ms. Loomis has really talked a lot about the technical elements of what the Secretary of State offices are going through right now. I had an opportunity to actually talk to our Secretary of State, Jerry Lynn Mann, this morning, telling her about this conference call and your hearing. So she was very interested in hearing that. Memorandum of understanding and agreement with the federal government. It was an event that featured herself and then Honorable Stuart Baker, who's the Assistant Secretary of Policy with the Department of Homeland Security. That we think was a very significant step. And we are hoping here in Michigan, she told me this morning that she's hoping to have applications physically available for people to fill out starting in January of 2009. So Washington State, I commend them. They've been one step ahead of us in many ways. I want to just quickly kind of go over a little bit of the history and sort of where we're through, and then maybe talk a little more about sort of the legislative side, how we had to deal with getting it through the legislature, because that is certainly a significant element to this. It's not just the policy. It's the how you maneuver it through the process. But it was about in 2005 as well that the Trade Chamber of Commerce
Detroit lies on the international border with Sarnia, and whole really region is symbiotic. It really has a tremendous amount of crossover that happens not just on a tourist basis, but on a daily basis with business people crossing. And certainly something that is a significant element to us is the automotive industry. Literally, they have done studies showing pistons that are ending up in vehicles will cross the border 9 different times as they're getting one process done in Ontario, another process done in Michigan or Ohio. Another great example is actually Chrysler. In the morning, they will put in an order in an interior plant in Ontario, which does headliners and seating, and literally those headliners and seats will be installed in vehicles in Michigan in the afternoon. So cross-border trade is for a daily business element is vital. We also then, of course, have North American International Auto Show that is a huge draw for us in the area. It is something that has obviously been buttressed by the automotive suppliers and in the industry. Then we also have tourism, entertainment, the Tigers, the Red Wings, not that there's that many Red Wings fans in Ontario. I think they just come across for the rivalry with the Leafs. Frankly, nobody's a Lions fan, including those of us in Michigan right now, but the Pistons and the casinos that we have there as well. There is a lot of that entertainment dollar that goes back and forth. And really one of the main issues on that was identified why this was needed was the cost of the passports. And Ms. Loomis talked a little bit about that prompted by somebody's question. This is really, in many ways, a question about cost and convenience. It's a much lower cost than possession of passports. And frankly, my family is a very good example of it. My wife is from the outskirts of Toronto. We met at university here in Michigan, and we have 5 young kids. This sounds worse than what it really is, but almost 11 down to 2. So we kind of packed them in there. I was looking at the cost of having to get 7 passports. That's pretty significant when you're buying a passport for a 2-year-old. And as they indicated in Washington, we have sort of that same situation here in Michigan where you are able to purchase and receive a state identification card. So it's not just a driver's license. It is an enhanced ID card that has been in the game plan. Some of the roadblocks that we came into was really the question of, is this needed? Especially for those out of state. And what I mean by that is not just down in that region of Detroit, which sees the cross-border traffic on a daily basis, but those of us out of my district, I should let you know, is on the Sunset side of Michigan. I'm on the west coast, on the shores of Lake Michigan, just west of Grand Rapids. There's a lot of people that don't necessarily have that connection in with Detroit. I'm actually closer to Chicago than I am to Detroit, and in many ways oftentimes identify with that sort of area rather than the Detroit area. And so it's been some education, and I really became educated on this when I chaired the Commerce Committee in the House of Representatives back a term ago when we were in Missouri. That really became crystal clear to me. And then talking with the automotive suppliers that I have in my area, we have a lot of Tier 1, Tier 2 automotive suppliers that interact with car companies and manufacturers, not just in Michigan, but also in Ontario. And that cross-border traffic that was going means that they have to be sending employees back and forth oftentimes by car because they've been trying to catch an airplane in Grand Rapids and then have them fly. And they drive, half an hour, 45 minutes, or an hour away. They will oftentimes just get people in a car and send them. And the same thing with our office furniture industry. We have the 3 none of them are land-based, and so there is a sort of a heightened awareness of what that security means. We've had our bridges locked down. In fact, a couple of different times, especially around 9/11, we actually had car assembly plants shut down because things were not being able to cross the border. And that sort of heightened awareness has sort of made everybody look at this very, very closely, trying to figure out whether we really needed to have this. There was another issue dealing with the cost. Even though this is cheaper than a passport, it is more expensive than a traditional regular driver's license. And up until this point, everybody was able to cross basically just declaring their citizenship. Literally, you roll up, how many citizens, which country. In my case, my wife for a period of time early in our marriage was still a Canadian, so when we started having kids, it would be like three Americans, one Canadian, you know. The border guards are used to that, but it always raises a little bit of a red flag. When we were starting to require people, especially on either fixed incomes or in lower income bracket, to cross the border needing some sort of enhanced identification, whether it be a passport or this program, there's a lot of concern with that. The problem was that really wasn't our call. It was state, it was the federal government's call. And I think everybody agrees we needed to increase our security procedures to make sure that this wasn't going to happen again, and that we weren't going to be able to have some of that cross-border issues that we have had with the potential terrorists and those kind of things. So I guess in general, some misunderstandings or misassumptions about what the program would be. Again, Michigan, much like Washington, is optional. People don't have to go get this. There isn't going to be an additional cost unless they choose to get this. As was pointed out, it does have an RFID chip. Or will have, well, I should say, Michigan has not implemented that yet. We're in that process right now. But it will have that RFID chip. There are some people that are uncomfortable with that. Again, as was pointed out, that is the same technology that exists in your passport. If you are using a passport across the border, it is the same technology. And in fact, you can make the argument that it is more, potentially more secure if it has one more filter to come through.
Representative Huizenga,
that is actually another potential security breach, and I guess time will tell to a certain degree as to how good that technology is.
Representative Huizenga, I have a question. Ms. Loomis indicated that the RFID and the Washington licenses did not have any personal identification information, just a serial number. Are you using the same kind of technology? Are you aware of what kind of technology they'll be using for the RFID in Michigan?
Madam Chair, I am not sure about that. In fact, I wrote that as down as a question myself when I heard that discussed, because the way the legislature passed the bill just authorized the Secretary of State to come to the agreement with the federal government, with this one caveat. We have exactly the same language in that I believe Ms. Loomis talked about. The law specifies what personal information that they maintain may be disclosed by the Secretary of State, with particular instances when that information is authorized to be released. The bill retains those provisions. It allows the Secretary to disclose those copies of the images and that kind of thing, but all within the context of what current law is as well. So my suspicion is that the system will be very, very similar to what Washington is.
Thank you. Do you have any further information or experiences to share with us?
Sure. What we did in Michigan as well is there was the each application that they examine for an original enhanced driver's license. And then if the application is not denied, the money refunded is paid to the county of the local treasurer and is appropriated to the county municipality for the purpose of carrying out the act. There was definitely a recognition that there was some additional cost here to those money. And so that was one way of trying to deal with that for us, Michigan, the local question of costing to local clerks. Also, the state treasurer would deposit the sum of $4 to the traffic law enforcement and safety fund for each person examined for the original enhanced driver's license. And then except as otherwise provided, what we have, and I can get you some language as well, with $4.50 of that original license and $6 of the renewal, which would be appropriated to the Transportation Economic Development Fund. So there was some funding vehicle in here for some other things. And then $2.5 million that was not being credited to the general fund, except not more than $1 million would be credited to the gasoline inspection and testing fund. So as you would well suspect, protection of fiefdom does creep into this. And I would just caution you maybe on that element, making sure that this is not used as a way to just start funding general government. That was a concern many of us had.
Representative Heisinger, what was generally considered to be the cost of the program if it was going to be revenue neutral? What would the cost have been if it wasn't being used as a source of revenue for other purposes?
Sure. The part of that was because it was a bit unknown. I mean, we're taking a little bit of a shot in the dark on some of this. Other than our current Secretary of State, Terry Lynn Land, is a former county clerk as well, and she recognized that as they were processing that, there was going to be a cost. So if you lump in that cost element and you can separate it out as just to the state, or if you take in, you know, what might be the local, that's how they determined working with the other clerks. They determined the $2.50 application examination fee. What came in from state police, for example, was arguments of different upgrade technology to do some of those things. That's why the $4 into the traffic law enforcement and safety fund. To me, it's a little bit of a stretch to say that we're going to have to credit $1 million to the gasoline inspection testing fund or to the general fund as being an actual cost to that. And I think that was a bit of a stumbling block for us, but it was somewhat lower than the $50. And my recollection is that the way that the language originally read was up to $50 was inclusive language.
Thank you. Senator Stumpf has a question for you, Representative Heisinger. Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just looking over the proposed legislation for Minnesota. And one of the provisions is that the department may not issue an enhanced identification card to an individual under 19 years of age. Why would that provision, do you have such a provision? And I guess I'm also asking the chair why we would have such a provision too.
Representative Heisinger, do you have an age limit for eligibility for receiving an enhanced ID or a driver's license?
Madam Chair, my recollection is no, we do not, for much the same reasons I think it was indicated by Ms. Loomis, we needed to have a way to address, or we felt we needed to have a way to address some of those families we're going to, if they weren't able to get this enhanced identification, we're going to have to go out, in my case, get five kids, you know, 11 and under, all passports.
Senator Stump, I'm going to ask Pat McCormick from the Public Safety to respond to that question in terms of how it came up in the bill that was introduced. And we did hear, I think, from Ms. Loomis, is that they do not have an age requirement in Washington, so that minors are eligible for enhanced IDs, even if they are not eligible for enhanced driver's licenses. Ms. McCormick?
Good morning, Madam Chair, and
you
members
need
of the
to
committee.
Bring the mic closer to
Sorry.
You, if you don't mind.
Pat McCormick, Director of Driver and Vehicle Services with the Department of Public Safety.
Ms. McCormick.
When we worked with Senator Rest on this proposal, Department of Homeland Security hadn't finalized their regulations, and at that particular time, we were going with what we looked as the regulations that were in place for the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative, and at that time, they said that you didn't need to have an ID card or enhanced driver's license or ID card until age 19. Since that time, and then I do mention it in our handouts, the age limit now in terms of who needs to have either a passport or an enhanced driver's license would be, or an enhanced ID card would be individuals 16 years of age and older. Under 16, or if you're in a school group under 19, you have to be able to show a certified birth certificate. And so that was one of the suggested changes I was going to mention to the committee in terms of the legislation that was drafted this past session.
Thank you.
Did I answer your question? I think we'll be able to learn from the experience in Michigan and Washington, other places, when a new bill is introduced in the 2009 session. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for Ms. McCormick, don't we have a requirement, though, if you get your driver's license, it's a provisional driver's license before you're 18, and then when you turn 18, you have to get a new license to show that you have a regular license. How would that work, do you think? Would they then have to pay for another EDL license if they wanted that?
Ms. McCormick?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, I think that those details would need to be worked out. The draft that we made some suggestions for Senator Rest, at that time we excluded provisional licenses from this particular draft. So we'd have to go in and really look at all the regulations and then determine what we would do in terms of that if this was enacted into law, how we would transfer that over from a provisional to an enhanced driver's license at that particular time. The reason would be you still would be able to renew under the legislation right now, but the reason I think you're bringing it up is because of the cost that would be involved, and so that would be something that would have to be looked at in probably a redraft that might be coming from Senator Rest in the next session.
We would definitely be looking at that. The whole purpose of this is to make it more convenient, not to make it more costly for people to have land and sea. I guess we would have very few sea crossings, but land crossings. Senator Roebling.
I'm just wondering about the differences. If Michigan has $50, it looks like ours is going to be 30-something possibly, and Washington is 15. Is somebody subsidizing Washington's, or have you just found a vendor that is able to provide this to you for less money?
Ms. Loomis, if you would rejoin us, please.
Thank you. As I mentioned before, we started out as a pilot. And starting out as a pilot, we did not know what the demand would be and what revenue would be generated by the program. And so in looking at trying to remain within the aspect of making it not a cost burden for somebody to obtain the license and to see the benefit from the cost perspective, we looked at various different aspects of what we were doing, what we were going to purchase, and settled on $15. And we estimated that for the pilot that we would then go back and look to see how much it's costing us and whether, you know, we were generating revenue to cover the initial investment in the program. We haven't, obviously, we have not recovered the cost of the investment in the program. We did negotiate with our vendor to try to contain the cost, and one of the things we did was to try to make sure that we were getting the best deal and that they were going to be the new vendor on the street with the ability to produce these documents and there potentially would be other states coming on board with it. So we tried to use as much leverage with them to try to maintain or contain the cost at a lower value. We will be looking at with this next session and looking at where we stand right now because we only have 8 months or so of actual collection of revenue with this and what we've looked at, trying to look at whether we are breaking even or not or whether it's actually costing the state more. We did not have a separation of funds. All our funds go into our transportation account, so it does not get sent into general fund or anything. It's not divided up that way. It just goes into the transportation fund. But we are tracking it separately so that we will know how much revenue we actually collect.
Ms. McCormick, in Minnesota, and I'm also responding or reacting to Representative Huizenga's description of the allocation of the funds or the fee that's raised. Driver's license applications and renewals, where are they deposited? Just so we get that on the...
Madam Chair, they're deposited in the driver services special revenue account. And there is a part of the driver fee also... Of the $24, there is a portion of that that goes to either DVS or it would go to a driver's license agent, whoever does that transaction. There's a part
deputy,
of that fee.
Not
the
deputy
or okay. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's where it's deposited. As you know, we have a fee-based system, and every biennium we review our costs and our production staff, our budget, as it pertains to driver's services, and then look at what the fees are that we are charging and determine whether they need to be raised or can stay at the same rate or lowered, whatever it might be.
And the intent is not ever to have excess revenues in that account. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Senator Roebling, then Senator Stump.
I was wondering, I know that when Real ID was implemented at the federal level, one of the reasons the states objected, there were several, but one of them was that there wasn't enough money coming to implement it. But wasn't there some money? And if so, is any of that available for a program like this to help buy down the cost maybe of purchasing some of the main infrastructure needed to put this in place?
Ms. McCormick or Ms. Loomis, or Representative Huizenga, do you know? I certainly don't.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, as you know, we're not implementing Real ID under the orders of executive order of the governor. But in terms of looking at the fees or the costs associated with it, there has been established a small grant program that states could get some funding for, but it's 56 jurisdictions and $50 million was the total of that particular amount of money. And they're still in the process of looking at who might be able to obtain the funding and for what purposes. You have to go through a regular grant process and make sure that it meets all the requirements of that program. And so there really is not additional funding that was made available at the federal level to be able to implement all the changes that were needed.
Senator Stumpf? Or Representative Heisinger, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just, somewhat related to this, I just wanted to make this point and commend Washington State and our own Secretary of State as well and others that have been working on this issue. I prior to being elected to the House of Representatives, I was actually the district director for a congressman who spent a period of time as the chairman of the Intel Committee. So I dealt with quite a fair number of security issues and how that would relate with Michigan. This was not, with all due respect to my good friends in the federal government, this was not something that they necessarily wanted to do. And in many ways, they weren't very enthusiastic because they, in many ways, felt that giving up something that was a federal government practice, you know, securing the borders and dealing with passport and in you know, the inflow and outflow of citizens and non-citizens. So that's why I think there's my fear is that we get into this that the federal government may, and whether it is because legitimately we have another issue or circumstances like 9/11 or, you know, heaven forbid the we lose a bridge or a tunnel or something that happens, you may see a tightening down of that. And I think that's why you are seeing as much information that is being required by the Fed to be included in on that. And I just wanted to commend, you know, Washington State and the others that have been working on this. But it is a cautionary tale, I think, of how far they may take this in the future as well.
Senator Stumpf, did you have a comment? And then I'll go to Ms. Loomis.
Oh, Madam Chair, just for my own information, is the Real ID, what's the term federal pass card? Is that the Real ID? Or is that?
Ms. McCormick?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Stumpf, the pass card is a modified passport that's a little bit lesser cost that would be able to be used for border crossings.
And but it's still an additional card.
It's still an additional card that you would have to obtain.
Ms. Loomis, do you have a comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to respond to the question with regard to funding. One of the challenges that I think the states had, Washington State also has a law that we cannot implement Real ID until we address privacy concerns and also the financial aspect of it. But in working with Homeland Security and through the Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators, what we learned after the grants were actually issued to states, and some states received $3 to $5 million. We did not apply because our initial understanding and legal interpretation that was given by FEMA was that those states that accepted the funding were going to be required to implement Real ID. It was after the distribution of the funding that the clarification was made that the states did not have to implement Real ID, but that if they were improving the security surrounding the aspects of the issuance process of the driver's license and ID cards, that the funding could be used to support any activity within the states. We've asked for additional clarification. There's been some recent FEMA instructions on the grants that have come out again trying to clarify that language. If you look at one document, it specifies that you are going to implement, the intent is to implement Real ID. You look at another document, it lessens the language so it does not, it's not as strong and just says that you're improving the security surrounding the issuance. So we're looking for hopefully to try to have a better clarification on that because we didn't apply for it either, and I think there was probably a handful of states that did not based on that information. But the other thing, too, that the states, there's other states that have decided that they were not going to apply for the Enhanced Driver's License Program was because they had indicated that it was not going to be compliant with Real ID. And as you can see, they have changed that perspective. So I imagine that there'll be more states that will want to come online to be able to support and operate a program such as the Enhanced Driver's License and ID card. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Loomis. Representative Heisinger, do you have any further comments for us at this point? I guess not. Thank you again, Ms. McCormick.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. Did you have anything further to add before we move on?
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity and commend Minnesota for taking a look at this. And obviously, you all need to figure out whether it's the right thing to do for your constituents and for your citizens. And we are here in Michigan is all I can relate to, but we are seeing an increased trade, an increased need for crossing the border, and we have to somehow strike a balance, that balance of security as well as convenience as we're dealing in a world that is continually flat. It sounds a bit trite, but it really is in many ways true, especially as we're seeing it in our manufacturing sector. So thank you for the opportunity.
Well, we thank you, Representative Heisinger, for your leadership in this on this issue and in Michigan, and for your service to your constituents. And thank you again for joining us. At this point, we'll move on to discussion of the implications for Minnesota, and welcome the comments of Ms. Pat McCormick, who is, as she has already identified herself, the director of the Driver and Vehicle Services of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. Ms. McCormick, we're happy to hear from you.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I did provide you with two different documents. One just outlined the provisions from our standpoint of Senate File 3850, which was introduced last session.
And I might add, we introduced that very late in the session just to have a document on the table for the purposes of discussion over the interim. And we have seen already, as Senator Roebling has brought up, I think an issue with regard to young people that will have to be resolved in this bill. As we presented again in 2009, based on changes and negotiations that have gone on between states and the experience of states like Michigan and Washington with DHS. So, Ms. McCormick, thank you very much for doing that. We appreciate the summary.
Sure. I just want to state that we welcome the opportunity to have this dialogue with Senator Rest and with the committee. We're not officially taking a position on this legislation, but we certainly are open to the discussion of it and the proposal. A couple things I didn't mention that would need to be changed in the legislation would have to do with the fact that the fees are different in this bill than in what they currently ended up being at the end of the session. So those would be some of those technical things that we would need to be corrected. But in order for us to implement this program, there would be one important factor that we'd have to come into agreement with, and that would be the fact that we are at the point where we are now beginning to write a request for proposal for our current driver's license card. And so it would need to, our RFP request would need to include defining what we would need in order to successfully incorporate this program into our regular driver's license program. And we would need to determine what those costs would be that a vendor would require in order to produce an enhanced driver's license or an enhanced driver's license or an enhanced ID card. In terms of our process, just looking at a timeline, as I said, we're just beginning the writing of the RFP right now. We would believe that if things go according to the usual procurement schedule, we could be signing a contract probably the earliest would be September of 2009 would be the earliest, and it may be a little bit later depending how the
procurement process. Are you currently having discussions with vendors, or are you still writing the RFP?
We're still writing the RFP. And, you know, as we stated, and most states are looking at between $15 and $30 additional cost associated with the enhancement, because you're adding the RFID chip and embedding that, as well as making sure that you would have the various scanning process that you would need, and also just the card features that you would have. We believe right now Minnesota has one of the more secure driver's licenses. We do meet the standards that Ms. Loomis talked about in terms of the AMVA security framework. We already do meet those standards, but obviously we believe that you need to always be enhancing and looking at other ways to make the driver's license more secure, because it's a matter of kind of staying ahead of what things are being done in order to try to fraudulently produce driver's licenses. So that's why we routinely do a contract on a five-year basis. And so we would need to look at what those costs might be and how that would fit into our process. In addition, we'd probably have to be able to do some kind of database expansion and also work on the same data privacy agreements with the Department of Homeland Security that Ms. Loomis talked about with the state of Washington. We certainly would not provide access to our database to the department. It would be a matter of providing access to specific data with Border Patrol.
And you would not provide them with the database either.
No, we would not provide them with the database. And in addition to that, we also would need to look at a new application process, so there'd be some costs associated with that. We do, on a yearly basis, provide training to all of our staff and our driver license agents in terms of fraudulent document recognition, so that you're able to know what to look for when people bring in different identity documents, social security cards, immigration documents, birth certificates, what you need to look at in order to determine whether the document is fraudulent. And we do that on a yearly basis. I think that that's something we would just be continuing to do, but obviously this would be more things that we would need to look at in that process. And then our current mainframe system, as all of you know, is needing to be redesigned, and we have secured funding now to begin that process. That's a four-year process that we're undertaking right now, and we would be working on that, and this certainly would be, if we were charged with doing this program, then we would certainly have to incorporate this as part of our redesign effort. A lot of the things that need to be done would include verification that you would need to do with other electronic systems. Right now, we do not. We're working on capability of doing some of those processes as part of the redesign effort, and we would be doing that. But right now, we're doing most things on a manual basis in terms of checking with other systems, because we don't have the capability to easily do that. So those would be some things that we would need to be looking at. And then I also just outlined the things that we would need to make sure that in any license or ID card, as Ms. Loomis mentioned, we would need to make sure that we're meeting all those levels of security in the AMVA security framework and the RFID chip, the machine readable zone. So because I, as far as I could see in the website with the Department of Homeland Security at the current time, none of the stations that we have in our area would be the type that are using would be using the RFID chip, at least in this first juncture. So it would be needing to be doing the scanning. And then we would also have to identify the cards as the PowerPoint showed in Ms. Loomis's presentation. And what we're looking at would be to have, if it's a provisional license, having it on a portrait side versus the others, the way we use the regular driver's license, changing that so that you know if someone is a younger, you know, a new driver and under a provisional license, which is under 19 years of age. So those would be the major changes that we would need. And I'd be glad to answer any questions. We would also have to outline identification documents that we would use. And we do have a list that we use right now, but it wouldn't pertain because we those documents list documents for legal presence. And at this point in time, the only people that would be able to get this license would be citizens, so the legal presence documents wouldn't apply. So it might be that we could, if we were implementing this, if it wasn't enacted into law, we would have to look at probably revising our current identification rules so that we could add something in that particular part of our administrative rules, I would assume, to work for this particular program.
Questions? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. McCarrick, I was just wondering, you said that the fee had changed during discussions last spring. What did it change to?
It's, Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, it's $24. So that there was a $1.75 fee added, a technology surcharge for us to be able to redesign our information system. That was added to driver's license transactions, title transactions, and registration renewals.
Was that in the transportation bill or somewhere else?
Madam Chair, yes, I think it was in the budget compromise.
Any other questions or comments from Ms. McCormick? I look forward to working with you to get the bugs out of this, and also with Senator Saxhog, Senator Bach, Senator Stumpf, and Senator Gimsey was on the original bill put out for discussion, too. I do think there's a lot of interest in making sure that the details don't become the devil. So thank you very much for your work on that. Other questions? Senator Gimsey, and then back to Senator Roebling, and then we have a couple of other testifiers. We had planned for this hearing to end at 12:30, and we will keep on that schedule. Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just real quickly, for my information, I know that we went through a facial scanning recognition process, or are we currently going through that? How far along are we, and can you give us some feedback as to what the results might be?
Ms. McCormick.
Madam Chair and Senator Gimsey, the you are correct. The facial recognition project that we're working on, it was made possible through a grant through the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, and this grant was specifically targeted. The reason we got it from that group is because it was specifically targeted for commercial drivers. But in order to do it for commercial drivers, we have to do it. We would do it on our entire database of driver's license photos. We don't have the results. We're expecting them in January, but I think the end of January is when we expect the results. And so, from what I've heard, as Ms. Loomis stated, and from every other administrator that I've talked to that works in this area, there is always a number of duplicate photos and cards, and it's an effort that's well worth doing. It takes, as Ms. Loomis stated, the photo recognition part of it, the scrubbing, as they call it, is only the first step, because then once we get that information, our staff have to really go in and do the research as to, was it because of a clerical error where it didn't show up and so we just issued another license? Was it because of fraud? There's various reasons that it could be. Or was it because the person was out, left the state for a certain amount of time, came back with a different name because of marriage or whatever, and so as a result, we didn't find them on our database, so we issued a brand new license, and it was a brand new entry into our system. So there's a lot of research that has to go in after we do that, but certainly we'll be updating you after we finish with that project. So,
Senator Roebling?
Thank you. You know, I think this EDL sounds like a good idea, but I do have one concern that Ms. Loomis mentioned, is that it sounds like Homeland Security has not guaranteed it beyond 2011. And so, I mean, since we're not even underway with the process yet, and if we would first get our first EDL cards next September or October, have them available, and all of a sudden in 2011 they might not be acceptable as a form of identification to cross the border, then we've done a lot of work for not much time. And so I'm just wondering about that whole discussion of how are we going to figure out how long these identification cards would be good for.
I think that's a very valid point. I guess I would also raise the kind of the question of the unknown also, because the DHS has been, it's been a moving target kind of what they require, what they're going to allow, and it's vastly different as we know from Washington's experience going progressing from when they started out what was going to be acceptable and then what now is acceptable, and just going to the young people's IDs, for example. And we know that, and certainly I'll ask for Ms. Luma's comment, but we know that Real ID, for example, has encountered tremendous opposition, not only for cost, but also for security and protection of people's privacy. Minnesota's not going to implement it under executive order. I believe Washington State actually passed legislation. So there's a lot of tremendous amount of resistance to it, and perhaps DHS is going to be revising not only what the requirements are with regard to security and privacy, but also the cost to the states. But Ms. Loomis, if you would give us your experience with regard to Senator Roebling's concern. When are the Olympics, by the way?
2010.
They are in 2010, so you're covered for that.
Yes. And just to clarify, when I made the comment about the our card being acceptable as materially compliant for 2011, that was specific to the Real ID requirements. The Enhanced Driver's License is a program, which is why when we first started out as
independent
a pilot
of Real ID.
Independent,
yes,
of Real ID.
That's an important
point.
Right.
Is an Enhanced Driver's License program, and it is an acceptable document, and it actually is in the rules as an acceptable alternative document for border crossing at land and sea borders. So that is not going away. But the relationship of the Enhanced Driver's License to the Real ID is that they will accept it as a Real ID document until December of 2011 as being materially compliant, unless they change the rules in some fact. But for border crossing, it is a program, and it is acceptable.
Okay, so that won't. That's a very important clarification. I didn't understand that either. That is very significant. So we wouldn't be moving forward with something that would then not be acceptable as a border document 18 months after we had initiated it. And we still might not go with Real ID even at that, but this is a separate program. Thank you very much, Ms. McCormick. Next, we invite Mr. John Edmond, who is the director of Explore Minnesota Tourism. We'll hear from him, and then by phone, Mr. Schultz, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Great. And then from Pete Schultz, who is the director of International Falls Convention and Visitors Bureau, we'll hear first from Mr. Edmond. What impact will the potential of this kind of program have on tourism and for Minnesotans from your office's point of view?
Well, Madam Chair, member, my name is John Edmond. I'm director of Explore Minnesota Tourism. Thank you, first of all, very much for giving us this opportunity to appear at this discussion about enhanced driver's licenses. I'm not here as an expert on enhanced driver's license and neither being a proponent or an opponent of the prospect, but I'm rather here to kind of put it just more generally into perspective about the importance of travel and tourism to the state of Minnesota. I think our primary concern in this whole discussion is to ensure the smooth travel of consumers, of individuals, of businesses, of travel between Canada and the United States, United States and Canada, for the benefit of tourism and trade while still balancing our security interests. Tourism is huge in the state of Minnesota, and I'll be relatively brief here. It's huge in Minnesota. It's a $10 billion industry. A lot of times people don't really understand how big it is. It's comparable to agriculture in terms of its importance. Over 244,000 jobs and over $3.7 billion in wages. Preserving secure and open travel into and out of the United States is essential for good relations with neighboring countries. And Canadian travel to Minnesota and to the United States represents our largest international visitor volume. Total Canadian travel to Minnesota in 2007 exceeded 2.6 million visitors who spent $278 million in our state. This represents an increase of 39% in Canadian visitors from 2000 to 2007 and a 137% increase in spending. And we've seen that a lot this last summer as well with the value of the Canadian dollar, of people coming here for shopping and for entertainment. We're seeing that is one of our real bright spots in travel this last summer is the number of travelers coming to Minnesota from Canada. Canadian visitors engage in many activities, outdoor recreation, shopping. It infects all parts of our state, not just the border communities. Canada is the Mall of America's most important international market. And with the increase in the change in currency last year, the Mall of America saw 300,000 Canadian visitors last year. The majority of Canadian visitors drive to Minnesota. The Winnipeg market is strong given its proximity. It's about a six-hour drive to the Twin Cities. An enhanced driving license, I think, will allow easier border crossings for Minnesotans who are traveling to Canada. Important point, however, this will have no impact, though, on the number of Canadian travelers visiting to Minnesota unless there's a reciprocal agreement that we developed with our neighboring provinces. And one of our primary interests is bringing new tax dollars into the state, bringing Canadians. And so a lot of this discussion on enhanced driver's license is dealing with the outflow, which is important, particularly for the border communities, the cross-border transactions. But our interest is making sure that we have the free flow of travel from Canada to the United States. As you know, in June of 2009, Canadians will be required to have a passport to enter the U.S., which means an increased cost for Canadians who don't have passports and will then need to get them. The cost of acquiring passports, coupled with the declining rate of exchange, makes it more expensive for Canadians to travel here. Those costs, plus additional delays in custom lines and patrols, all have an impact on Canadian travel to the United States. So the bottom line is we want to make sure that the enhanced driver's license is done in such a way that it continues to encourage travel both ways from Canada to the United States and the United States to Canada, because tourism and travel is extremely important to Wright County in Minnesota. All parts of the states are affected, and we hope that you keep this in mind when you're working through this draft legislation to create an enhanced driver's license program. Thank you very much.
Mr. Edmund, I would point out that in addition to British Columbia, there are other Canadian provinces that are undertaking an enhanced driver's license program, and including the two that we share a border with, Manitoba and Ontario, as well as Saskatchewan. And the estimated start date for Manitoba is the fall of 2009, and in Ontario, the winter of 2009. So I think our Canadian border provinces are well aware of the tourism and trade relationship that we have. And again, Canada is our Minnesota's largest export market. So it's very, very important that we have, as you pointed out, that we want convenience and we want security. And we're not going to sacrifice security for the sake of convenience, but with careful legislation, seems to me that we ought to be able to accomplish both and not diminish the Canadian market for ourselves. Mr. Schultz, would you like to add your comments at this point from International Falls?
Thank you, Senator Rest, and the committee members and guests. I appreciate the opportunity. What I have to add isn't much over what you've already heard. In the border area here, the concept of a passport, while understood, is not exactly welcome, because you do have to have one for every member of the family. It's a second document to carry. And we believe the government can have an enhanced driver's license or secure form of ID that can allow us to cross the travel, because many of us frequently cross the border. There are families that share the border, live on either side. There are people that have jobs in Fort Francis and live in the U.S. and so on. And then another issue would be in the terms of tourism. It's a welcome thought that Ontario is working on that, because we're counting on getting some Ontario business with their stronger dollar. They can take back more U.S. merchandise if they spend $48 in the U.S., and that's great for U.S. lodging. And the same is true of U.S. citizens going to Canada, that some misunderstanding about the passport issue may be costing Canada some money. We've had people call our offices all summer who've said, I don't want to go through the hassle of getting a passport. It's expensive. I've got four kids, so on and so forth. So they're skipping their trip to Canada this year. And it's hard to explain to them that they can pass through with a driver's license or an ID and a birth certificate. Right now, they're just not that interested. But if you had an enhanced driver's license available when they renew their driver's license, they might change their mind if they find that it's going to be a cheaper and easier way to cross the border.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz. And I agree with you that a lot of it, the ease of travel, a lot of it is the perception of how we can come and go. And I know as a child crossing into Canada, all they ever asked you was, where were you born? You didn't have to show any kind of documents. And it was almost as if Canada was not a foreign country, and vice versa. And the crossings were very easy and just based on verbal affirmation of citizenship. Times have changed, and we respect that and acknowledge that, but we also want to maintain an extremely positive relationship with the country of Canada and our two neighboring provinces. Thank you very much, Mr. Edmund and Mr. Schultz. And now I'd like to welcome for our final testimony and comments, Mr. Tony LaRusso, who is the Executive Director of the Minnesota Trade Office, recently returned from China. with trade mission there and preparing to travel to Israel with Governor Pawlenty in the near future. Thank you very much for joining us, and we welcome your comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I'm Tony LaRusso, the Executive Director of the State of Minnesota Trade Office, and I am suffering some jet lag at the moment, but this is a very exciting and interesting topic. Like John Edmond, I don't have a position one way or the other on enhanced driver's license, and I'm not an expert on enhanced driver's license. But certainly I'm supportive of any efforts that continue to facilitate the effective and convenient flow of goods, services, capital, and people across our border in a manner which ensures our national security as well. You know, with all due respect to the hundreds of countries that we do business with, there's no country that's more important to us in terms of trade than our relationship with Canada. I don't need to give this audience a history lesson on the extent of our historical and cultural and trade and tourism relationship with Canada, so I'm going to skip through some of these slides really quickly. But I wanted to take this opportunity to at least paint a large picture as to why this relationship with Canada is so important to the state of Minnesota, and why the Canadians view this relationship as important to them as well. As you well know, we have only two permanent consulates in the state of Minnesota. One is Mexico, and the other is Canada. So the Canadian government, through their Consulate General in Minneapolis, Consulate General of Canada in Minneapolis, places great emphasis on its relationship with Minnesota as well. So we're very pleased that we have government representation in our state from Canada. I'm going to skip over the slide on tourism since John Edmond covered that in great detail, and I want to keep this committee on track to be out of here at 12:30. But Minnesota also has an extensive sister city relationship with Canadian cities as well. Minneapolis has a sister city with Winnipeg, Duluth with Thunder Bay, and Little Canada also with Thunder Bay. So I'm not sure what Thunder Bay is doing there, but they have a great interest in Minnesota, so we're excited about that. But from a trade and investment perspective, which is really my area of expertise, we have a significant relationship between Minnesota and Canada. There are nearly 100 Canadian companies that have major investments in Minnesota that require that free flow of goods and people across the border. We may recognize some of those companies as Thomson Reuters, Snyder's, New Flyer, and Canadian Pacific, or some of those Canadian companies that have investments here in our state. And there are approximately 50 Minnesota firms that have operations in Canada. Some recognized ones, of course, are 3M, Cargill, Best Buy, Medtronic, and others. But besides these corporate giants, so to speak, there are also hundreds, if not thousands, of small to medium-sized companies that also do business across the border as well. From an export perspective, I'm very pleased to say that Minnesota reached a record high not only in our manufactured exports globally, but also to Canada last year. Our exports globally reached a little over $16 billion of manufactured goods that we export to about 190 countries around the world. And we reached a record high with Canada at $4.3 billion in manufactured exports. Putting that in a little different perspective, you can see the percentage of increase of our exports globally as well as to Canada. So for Canada, last year, we saw a 21% increase in Minnesota's manufactured exports to Canada. Globally, we saw a 6.5% increase. So again, that growth to Canada is pretty significant. Canada accounts for about 25% of our exports for our state. We actually export more to Canada than we do to our next four major trading partners. Most of what we export to Canada today really falls in the area of transportation equipment and iron ore and some computers and soybean residue as well. And then, again, the largest category is other category. It's a smattering of major industry, a lot of other industries. But the largest export category is actually trucks. And I would attribute that to the Ford Ranger, the Ford plant in St. Paul. The provinces that we primarily export to, Ontario and Manitoba, the two that we share borders with, of course, is where most of our exports go to. And then Saskatchewan, Alberta, British Columbia, Quebec make out the others that we export to. Just to give you a quick history lesson, of course, we are a geography lesson. Of course, we share the border with Manitoba and Ontario. From the Canadian perspective, they export about $11 billion to us. So we export $4 billion to them, $11 billion to us. And they primarily export crude oil and gas and electrical energy to Minnesota. And we get most of that from Alberta and Saskatchewan. There are 7 land border crossings in Minnesota with Canada, 3 on the Ontario side and 4 on the Manitoba side. And our data tells us that approximately 90% of the shipments that we make across that border are by surface as opposed to air. International Falls is the area where we see most loaded trucks crossing the border. About 38% of all truck crossings happen at International Falls. Grand Portage is the next border crossing that has the greatest deal of volume.
Don't most of the trucks go through Pemberton?
They do, but I'm only looking at the Minnesota crossing as opposed to the North Dakota.
There's a lot of crossing there that represents a benefit to the state of Minnesota. I mean, it's a major, major crossing, as you well know.
You are absolutely correct, Madam Chair. Absolutely correct. But just looking at the 7
like
Minnesota.
5 miles or so into North Dakota there.
You know, I don't claim North Dakota, though.
Mm-hmm. I see. I wouldn't ask you.
There was a question earlier, too, about passengers as well. And our data shows that about 2 million passengers cross these 7 border crossings as well. So it's about 47,000 loaded trucks annually and about 2 million passengers annually through these 7 Minnesota ports. Again, that's just a quick overview of Minnesota's very strong and extensive relationship with Canada. And again, it's very important from the trade perspective that we maintain a very open border with our northern partners. Thank you.
Are there any questions or comments for Mr. LaRusso?
Madam Chair, I have some additional handouts I'll leave here as well.
Thank you. We will distribute them to the members. Appreciate that. Are there any other questions or comments for today? I will remind the members that if you are available, we do have a large group coming tomorrow for the rulemaking workshop, and we're looking forward to hearing from Judge Bruce Johnson, major presentation for members of our committee and staff in both the House and the Senate, for which we have about 50 people coming, for which our lawyers seem to be particularly interested because they're getting an hour CLE credit. Ms. Berezovsky, there you go. Anyway, we thank you very much. Mr. LaRusso.
Madam Chair, I do have the statistics on Pembina as well.
Okay.
I indicated that 47,000 loaded trucks cross our 7 borders, our 7 crossings.
Mm-hmm.
For Pembina, there are 200,000.
Yes. But many of them, I mean, they're coming into Minnesota. They're not going to North Dakota, or they're coming through Minnesota, and they're going from Minnesota to Winnipeg. So, well, thank you very much, members. I appreciate your attendance today, and we will be moving forward with Senator Saxog, Senator Stump, Senator Bach on a proposal for the 2009 legislature, and we look forward to working with Ms. McCormick. We hope to have support from the governor's office as we move forward, and I think it's an important discussion for us to be having with regard to tourism and trade. Thank you very much.
Madam
Senator
Madam
Day.
Chair.